WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
A sleight-of-hand artist and a scholar of the unusual, that's how my guest Ricky Jay describes himself. His book, Learned Pigs and Fireproof Women, is an encyclopedia of attractions without parallel, sword swallowers, daredevils, freaks, and other sensational acts like Mac Norton, the human aquarium, who swallowed live goldfish and frogs in his performances. Ricky Jay has perfected a few astounding acts of his own. He's in the Guinness Book of Records for throwing playing cards 190 feet at 90 miles per hour. He's the curator of the Mulholland Library of Conjuring and the Allied Arts in Los Angeles. And he's worked with Joseph Papp and Francis Coppola, coaching actors in magic. And he appears in David Mamet's new film, House of Games, for which he also acted as a consultant on con games. Ricky Jay, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks.
Before we talk about your work as a magician and your knowledge of con artists, let's talk about some of the people in your new book. I want to ask you about John Cummings, who really, really interested me for some reason. He was a knife swallower who literally swallowed knives whole.
Yeah, I guess the most interesting thing about John Cummings is he was a sailor, an American sailor on some boats in Europe, and he no doubt witnessed the performance of a French magician who pretended to swallow knives in some drunken, boisterous aftermath. He decided that he could do anything this magician did and really swallowed these knives. He had a dinner of five or six knives, and then after his initial success, ran around having people gather all the cutlery in the ship until he had eventually swallowed every knife on the ship. And so he was a totally impromptu and an unprofessional sword swallower. But later, apparently, after consuming every potable in sight, he would repeat these odd bouts. And two or three other times in his career, he actually swallowed many, many knives.
And apparently, when they did the autopsy on him, they found about 14 knives embedded in his stomach.
Yeah, that's he actually once swallowed so many knives that he began this fairly visible emaciation in the weeks that followed his last knife-eating bout. And the autopsy did reveal these knives all in his stomach. He just swallowed case knives whole, you know, folding knives in cases and tableware cutlery, and eventually died from the lodging of one of the knives in his body.
Why are you interested in all these really eccentric acts?
Well, I should point out that you're the one who mentioned this. Although I did write about John Cummings, it was merely a footnote to other more professional acts. That John Cummings is not the focal point of this book. I do have a section on swallowing acts, people who ate this odd assortment of things. I mean, sword swallowers being the most famous. I suppose I have a true fascination with unusual entertainment. As you mentioned, I've been known to do some fairly unusual things myself, and over the years I've compiled data and playbills and books on all of these odd performers.
I'm going to ask you about somebody else who's in your book, and this is Johnny Eck, who some of our listeners might also know as one of the actors in Freaks.
Okay, before you explain, let me tell the story before you explain who he was in Freaks, for those who don't know his name, because I find this literally the single most bizarre tale in the annals of conjuring. What happened was that in the 1930s and 40s, a magician named Raja Raboid used to work a fairly large illusion show. Actually, I'll tell you an odd anecdote about Raja Raboid, which is not in the book, but since you mentioned I throw cards, Raja Raboid was a great card thrower in terms of this old game of throwing cards into a top hat. And he used to hustle in the millineries on Broad Street in the 30s. And there were all these hat boys used to sit in the backs of these shops and throw cards into hats and got very good at it. But Raja Raboid was actually quite remarkable at this stunt. And he would go in and find these hat boys who thought they were great and get them to bet him, you know, a dollar per card for whoever throws the most cards in, or side bets of hundreds of dollars, whatever he could muster up. And if the hat boy would throw 42 out of 52 cards in the hat, that would be really wonderful. And Raboid would miss just as often as he had to have 40 cards in the hat and three cards left in his hand, and just happened to get all the last three in, so he would throw in 43. If the person threw in 28, he'd throw in 29. And he supplemented his income by hustling throwing cards in the hat. Anyway, he had this show, which was not a top-level show by any stretch of the imagination, but One year he decided he would do this variation of the standard sawing a magician, a magician's assistant in half. And he thought it would be much more interesting if he borrowed a volunteer from the audience, because everybody assumes the magician's assistant is in cahoots, or that there are two of them and there are actually two people in this cabinet instead of one. And so he went into his shows and he asked someone in the audience to stand up. And instead of a woman, a man stood up in the audience. And this man, in full view of the audience, walked onto stage. And Roger Rabbi placed him in this box, and his assistants brought out a saw, and they sawed the box in half and pushed the two halves aside, and everybody applauded, and then they pushed the two halves back together, and the man got up and started walking back to the audience. And as he took a few steps downstage, suddenly his body toppled over in half. Literally, the trunk started walking off the stage to the left, and the pair of pants, the waist and legs of the man, started walking off the stage to the right. And people in the audience were gasping and fainting and screaming as they actually watched the trunk move into the left part of the aisle, and the pants move into the right part of the aisle. And the way he was able to accomplish this, even though I don't make a habit of exposing all these illusions, this is truly bizarre enough to talk about for your listeners. He had Johnny Eck, who was in Freaks and was only half a man. He stopped at the waist, actually a little lower than the waist, but the photographs always made it look like he was cut off right at the waist. And he, of course, was the half of the man that walked into the audience, you know, crawled into the audience using just his arms. And the other half was a midget with a pair of pants pulled up over his head. But the thing that made this such a remarkable story was that the original volunteer from the audience was Johnny Eck's twin brother, full-sized, completely normal twin brother. So I think that's what gave this remarkable verisimilitude and made people truly scream, is that they saw this man walk up, they switched him for the midget and Johnny Eck, and people just went wild.
Pretty remarkable. This is one of the acts that is mentioned in Ricky Jay's book. What's the title again? It's Learned Pigs and Fireproof Women, full of totally bizarre and astounding acts. Now, have you been to a lot of places where you can see acts like this in modern times? Have you been to freak shows, traveled with circuses, anything like that?
Well, I actually did briefly run a Carney 5-in-1 show.
You ran a freak show?
Yes, I actually did perform it. It seems like a strange job to have winding up
not
in a museum as a curator of rare books. But yeah, I did indeed. Yeah, it was a show that traveled along the East Coast. This was about 15 years ago, and it was a show that was in operation then. And we exhibited a number of attractions. The difference between a 5-in-1 and a 10-in-1 show are basically the number of attractions, 5-in-1 being smaller. Five different shows under one roof. I should do the pitch for you.
Would you?
Showtime, Circus Time, See the Magician, The Fireman Appellator, The Girl with the Yellow Elastic Tissue, The Electrode Lady. Yes, The Electrode Lady. She and her sister were struck by lightning. Her sister died, but she lived to tell the tale. 20,000 volts of electricity through the young girl's body. The doctor said she lived because she was immune to the shock of electricity. See the monster child from Johannesburg, South Africa, the monster child with one head, two bodies, three arms, and four legs. You read about it in your leading periodicals. You read about it in the National Enquirer. Then see Adam and Eve, boy and girl, brother and sister, all in one of the world's three living morphidites, which will expose itself not to be rude or vulgar, but to show you Mother Nature's curious mistakes. Showtime, Circus Time, let's go be going.
And did you write that yourself?
Oh, no. It's actually fascinating that almost anyone who has worked as a carny talker will do a variation of that speech. It's been handed down verbally, and the pronunciations like morphidite for hermaphrodite and curious for curious are pretty much the same way you'll hear them in most parts of the country. I mean, the problem being that these days you don't hear much of this at all. There are not too many shows like this in existence anymore.
Were the freaks in this freak show freaks or cons?
A combination. For instance, the monster child from Johannesburg, South Africa, was in fact what they call a pickled punk, or literally a fetus in formaldehyde, showing two heads, three bodies, four arms, three bodies and four legs. And that was, you know, a con. The hermaphrodite was also a con, which we'll dispense with for the moment. It was not a person with the sexes of both in one body, but a made up piece. But the fire eater and the sword swallower and the electrode lady were all you know, doing what they claim to be doing. I can't say that this woman really was able to resist the shock of electricity, but one could present her in a fashion that did.
What kind of getup did you wear to do the barking?
Nothing particularly elaborate. I mean, basically just street clothes, although the show was run by a rather sad old-timer with gold lame hair and lots of tattoos. And it was an odd group. I mean, the carny world is a very strange world, and these were strange folks.
The impression I have is that there aren't as many freak shows as there used to be, in part because we've all, I think, become much too self-conscious to go and gawk at the freaks. And I think also so that there are so many chemical deformities now that freaks have a different meaning, if you know what I mean?
I don't know. It's an interesting thought. I would think it has more to do with the fact that there are not as many natural freaks now as there used to be.
Gee, I thought in a way it would be the other way around.
No, I don't think so.
Of chemicals during pregnancy and things like
well,
that.
Well, there are some similarities. I mean, it's odd that we're off on this strange tack. I mean, I feel a certain need to tell your listeners that the book is not totally about freaks.
Right.
It's about remarkable performers. But this is a lead into a man who may be my favorite performer in the book. His name was Matthew Buchinger, and he was born in Nuremberg in 1674, and he was only 28 inches tall, and he had flippers very much like the deformities we saw when these horrible thalidomide cases came out a few years ago, just these little flippers. But this man was able to master the playing of more than a dozen musical instruments. He did absolutely remarkable calligraphy. He would throw swords and hit a mark. He would fire pistols. And he was a great conjurer. He was a great magician. And so well known that at one point he was actually considered the greatest German living. And there are elegies at his death, you know, in collections by Swift and other leading poets and playwrights of the day. I mean, he was remarkably accomplished. And extraordinary. But nevertheless, there seem to be many less people like that. A good example is Siamese twins, who now can almost always be split, although usually using very delicate operations. And so there are many less Siamese twins, for instance.
You know what I have to tell you? The person who you just mentioned, Buchinger, who had no limbs but was able to still paint with his mouth, I guess.
No, actually not. In his case, he pushed the flippers together. I do talk about some
people. But there's
the
a woman
Sarah Biffin, who painted with a brush in her mouth. Yeah.
Now, to show how I think things have changed on Our Magazine, which is a morning talk show TV magazine, they did a feature on a woman who had no arms and she painted with her toes. But this was, they pitched it as a self-help kind of thing, self-improvement. It's like, she could paint with your toes, you can do anything too. it was absolutely different from the freak show approach. I mean,
well, it's fascinating about both Miss Biffin and Buchinger that many of the people who were exhibited in this way in this book were very special in the sense that they weren't brought out and put with traveling showman's caravan. And were allowed to develop as people first. That was far more uncommon then than it is now. Far more uncommon, where they were easily exploited.
You once said, I think, that you would have liked to live in Elizabethan times. What would you have been able to see then or do then that you couldn't know?
Well, I think this demimonde, this odd world that I find so comfortable, was slightly more prevalent. You know, I've always had this fascination with street performers and entertainers and gamblers and con men. And in Elizabethan times, they were very much linked, strangely enough, with the writers of the day, the pamphleteers and writers. You know, that was considered a pretty strange profession to be able to sit down and write and try to earn a living. And so the interests that I have seem to, in some extent, coincide with that. I'm also a fan of canting terms, slang terms used by the criminal element in Elizabethan times and then on upwards. So,
my guest is Ricky Jay, and he describes himself as a scholar of the eccentric, and he's written a book called Learned Pigs and Fireproof Women. He's also a sleight-of-hand artist, and we'll talk more about his own work as a magician. But first, we're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Ricky Jay is my guest. Let's talk about how you first got interested in magic. Now, I think it was your grandfather who was
a magician? Was a well-known amateur magician in New York. He didn't do magic professionally, but in a way that was a great lesson because he was an amateur in the true sense of the word, a real lover of the art, and was a great influence on me. And he invented a lot of original magic and had things published during his lifetime. So I grew up not only with him, but with a chance to see other wonderful performers who very much influenced me as a kid.
I always think if you put a magician and a kid together, then the magician is going to pull quarters from the kid's nose, things like that, the standard magician tricks.
Yeah, that's the toughest image to overcome is that kind of... I've said somewhere that magic seems to me the only art form that's been shaped by amateurs instead of professionals because of that concept that most people have. They can't seem to tell the difference between their Uncle Harry who takes a quarter out of your ear and somebody who's worked 10 hours a day for their entire life to do, some really beautiful effect with a coin.
So this the quarters out of the ear isn't the kind of magic that you were exposed to by
your
uncle and your
friends? I was exposed to literally the best people in the world, many of whom are still alive. Sly Deeney, who's in his late 80s or 90 in New York. Di Vernon, who's 93 in California.
Would they show you the tricks, show you how they work?
Well, it's very interesting. There's kind of an unexpressed apprenticeship that one goes through. I mean, clearly I had access because of my grandfather in early age, but I didn't talk very much. I watched and tried to pick up what I could. But as I got older, for instance, I moved to California some 12 or 13 years ago to be with Vernon, who, as I mentioned, is still there in 93 and most people think is the preeminent figure in sleight of hand. And he would never accept money for lessons and he would always tell you he wasn't teaching you. But clearly he was. He was challenging you at every opportunity and making you think for yourself and inventing effects and even going beyond that. I mean, to the point of if you had invented something and you really were proud of it, he would kind of give you a smile, to lead you to believe it wasn't very good and then go and tell somebody else who was young and really an upcoming young performer that you had just invented this wonderful effect. And then he would come back and tell you that the other guy had just invented a wonderful effect. I mean, he really played the role of almost a Zen master. And try to get people to think really well for themselves. So.
One of your specialties is card throwing.
Yeah.
Oh, no, what do you do with a talent like that?
There's not a great demand for it. I think one establishes whatever demand there is. Early on, wound up throwing cards great distances. You know, as a kid in Brooklyn and then later in New Jersey, I mean, I threw baseball cards. And you used to have games, throwing cards for distance or closest to the wall or knocking down leaners. And I think maybe because I practiced with cards even at that young age a lot, I had some facility with it. And, it turns out that I throw these things farther and faster than anybody does. Actually, in the 20s and 30s, there really was a trend of stage magicians. Well, it goes back to the 1850s of magicians throwing souvenir cards to their audiences in large theaters and throwing cards into the balconies of theaters. Generally, they were heavier cards than actual playing cards. And my first book called Cards as Weapons was a study of self-defense with ordinary playing cards, giving techniques about how to throw them. And that's going to be reprinted by Warner's this coming year.
So. A kind of tongue-in-cheek.
I would have to confess, if pressed, that there were tongues and cheeks to be found in that book, yeah.
Well, you do a very ironic kind of magic in a way because you're, I think, commenting on the sleight of hand as you do the sleight of hand in
I suppose to some extent, yeah. I mean, certainly irony runs through the performance. I try to make it nonlinear. I don't want things to start out where you can anticipate their endings by the time I've given you the first sentence. So.
Now, you're also interested in con games. Do you consider magic a conning act?
Well, I at times feel that I have to draw the line. I mean, here we are talking about freaks and cons and all sorts of fields with some sort of pejorative connotation. And yet I believe that many of the people I write about in this book were great artists and that somehow one doesn't preclude the other, that there can be people who were absolutely wonderful artists, whether they're in this sort of netherworld area or not. It doesn't happen often, but when it does, it's very exciting.
What kind of venues have you come up with to perform your magic act in? Where did you start establishing yourself?
Well, I've really run the gamut. I mean, I worked early years where I would just do close-up magic. I rebelled against being on a stage, and I would wear, I think when I did The Tonight Show the first time 20 years ago, with hair down on my waist, wearing a T-shirt and a pair of jeans. I mean, that was a very strange way to be presenting it, but I hated that classic image of a magician then and refused to work on stage. Then I went through a period where I may have been the first magician to ever work consistently with rock and roll bands. I used to go on tour for almost 10 years of my life, opening shows for a wide variety of music acts, Cheech and Chong and Emmylou Harris and Herbie Hancock. And I mean, just the B-52s. I mean, and, you know, over a long period, I did that. I worked carny freak shows. I worked on the street. I worked in theaters. I worked every opportunity I could. And the venues were as different as they could possibly be, because that was a learning experience. But particularly the most difficult thing of all of those was working close-up. Now, the concept of close-up magic has gained a great deal in popularity. In most major cities, somewhere in a good restaurant or hotel will have a magician who comes to your table and does magic. But when I first started, I don't think there were more than a half a dozen people in the country who made a full-time living doing that. And so the difficulty was convincing someone to hire you. It wasn't the difficulty of making them enjoy what you performed, but rather, why would they want to put you in their room to begin with?
Is close-up magic more difficult because the person's eyes are that?
Well,
that
technically,
close to
you? It probably is. It's also why it gives me so much pleasure. Yeah, it's usually done with sleight of hand rather than with some tricked boxes or odd apparatus. You know, and as you say, if you're doing it surrounded with people, you know, right on your coat sleeves, you have to be good, and you know, that just made it more fun. And I think it makes the audience. It's to this day the most rewarding performances. You know, the most rewarding genre for me to be in.
You will be seen in the forthcoming movie House of Cards.
House of Games.
House of Games. I'm sorry, by David Mamet. And you're not only in it, but you consulted on con games.
Right. Yeah, it's a movie about a mob of con men, and I'm an actor in it. I don't do any magic, but I do play a gambler.
What kind of con games did you come up with for the movie?
Well, it's hard to explain them without tipping the movie. I mean, one of the nice things about seeing a movie with cons
is that we're
cons
at the same time.
Yeah, is that you are con. So I think I'll be cryptic about that, but it was fun. And the movie opened last week in both New York and Los Angeles, so I think it'll be soon in your cities. Yeah, it's in this particular case, it's a very interesting story about a woman psychiatrist being so intrigued with a con man that she meets in the course of her work that she wants to find out more about it, and is there's just a constant series of surprises. So.
Are there interesting swindles going on city streets today?
Yeah, sure. I mean, things. You know, one of the observations that I try to make in the book, and I don't spend a lot of time doing that. I mean, mostly I'm just presenting facts about people. But it does seem to me, and I mentioned in the introduction, that I believe people are swindled the same way now that they were in the Elizabethan times 400 years ago. They're fooled by the same things, and they're delighted by the same things. Very little has changed. There are swindling and cheating techniques done with cards and dice that are absolutely explained in detail in books from the 1550s that are still being done now.
Things like three card Monte.
Three card Monte doesn't go back that far. That's a fairly recent origin. But the three shell game, which is a version of thimble rigging, goes back to. I've been trying to trace it back to the 17th century, and I haven't been able to. But I've certainly been able to trace it back to the very early 18th century. By 1714, there are clearly references to swindlers using a pea under a thimble. And that game has changed very, very little in the ensuing years.
Have you ever gone up to swindlers or con men and tried to beat them at their own game?
It's a very dangerous thing to do. It's a very bad thing to do. I think there's some people in this field who think that if they're magicians and know something about this, this is a great opportunity for them. One has to make the distinction that these people are, for the most part, criminals. And even though I have, like I say, this respect for what they do and some great feeling, you can be in a very bad situation if you see somebody playing three-card Monte on the street and want to go up and say, I know something about cards too. I know how to do this move and make the queen go into the middle when it doesn't look like it's there. So no, I don't do that. But I have some friends and have had friends for many years who are on that side of the fence and still maintain my connections with them. But I don't walk up to people in the midst of a game and point out the queen, even though I can do that. It's not healthy.
For a while, you lived the carny life. You worked on this carnival show and Hawk the Freak show. Would you have wanted to stay in a life like that?
I don't know. I think the thing that's really intrigued me in my life and interested me in my life is that I've had the opportunity to do so many different things. I wouldn't want to spend 50 weeks a year in Las Vegas, but it's nice to spend one in Las Vegas. I've worked on cruise ships. Maybe every 5 years I decide it's nice to take a cruise and do that. But I've never found any one thing that would have kept me doing it for the rest of my life.
Did your parents ever, do you think, say to themselves, why did we bother assimilating and trying to be successful in business or whatever so that our son can run off and be a magician and join
I suppose if I were talking to them, they would have said something very much like that. But because that was clearly their attitude a long time ago, I haven't said a word to them for a good 20 years or so I wouldn't know.
Where have you been researching the bizarre performers
all over the world, really. I mean, I would go as a performer to different cities and different countries to perform and usually spend my days in the libraries researching. So I did a great deal of research at the British Museum and the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris and museums in Tokyo and in South America and even in Johannesburg. I mean, the strangest places. It's taken me almost 10 years to compile all of this information. But that was always a great pleasure. And I also scour rare bookshops and print shops, and I've collected this material for a long time as well.
Have you ever tried to do any of the more unusual acts?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, in my shows, I do lecture demonstrations fairly often about such things, and I do. And I try to make them a little different. Sometimes I'll do shows with specific historical accuracy, but usually I switch things. And for instance, Harry Kahn, who I mentioned in the book, the multiple mental marvel, who would hang upside down at a blackboard doing magic squares at the same time reciting poetry from any number of sources that you mentioned and shouting out the population of any city that you could name and writing with both hands and both feet, inspired a performance piece that I do. Where I do a chess problem called the Chess Knight's Tour. I have a big blackboard in the room, and I let a spectator pick any starting square. The board is numbered from 1 to 64. And from that point, without my ever looking at the board, I want to try to call out a series of moves that are all legitimate moves that a knight would make on the board. And at the same time I'm doing that, I do a reading from any Shakespeare play suggested by the audience and also do cue brutes mentally at the same time. So.
I'd like to see that sometime. I want to thank you very much for talking with us about magic and freaks and cons and eccentric performers. Thank you very much for being here.
My pleasure.
My guest has been Ricky Jay, who's a sleight of hand artist and has also written a history of unique, eccentric, and amazing entertainers. The book is called Learned Pigs and Fireproof Women, and it's just been published in paper by Warner Books. He can also be seen in David Mamet's new film, House of Games. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.